Hello, welcome to Germania, Divided and United. Episode 2.1, The God of Abraham. Welcome to Season 2 of the podcast. It is so good to be back. This season we will explore the spread of Christianity to the German tribes, a process that really got going during the 4th and 5th centuries after the reign of Constantine the Great. To set the table, the first few episodes will cover the history of the Church following the death of Christ and some of the fundamental building blocks of the faith. To keep up to date as we move forward, you can always follow me on Twitter and Instagram at GermaniaPod. At this point, I should disclose that I have spent my life within various Protestant denominations. My faith has waxed and waned over time, and currently I am a member of a Lutheran congregation within the ELCA. Lutheranism, the official religion of Germania, Divided and United. If that doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry about it. Just be aware that I might make the occasional snide comment about the Catholic Church. At points during this season, I'll be sharing passages from the Bible. When referencing the Bible, a great resource I've used is Bible Gateway, which I learned about through the History of the Papacy podcast. The benefit of Bible Gateway is that it provides multiple different translations of the Bible to toggle between, and it is interesting to see how different people, at different times, have translated and read the text. Unless otherwise specified, the translation I will refer to is the New King James Version. Before we cover the life of Jesus Christ, it would be good to have an understanding of the world he was born into. So let us take a very quick run through the history of the Jewish people and their status within the greater Roman world following the conquest of Pompey the Great. As a note, I am going to avoid attempting Hebrew pronunciations and stick with the anglicized names for people and places going forward. It will be better for everyone. With that note, this 25-minute summary of the first 3,000 years of Jewish history is definitely comprehensive and exhaustive, and every rabbinical school out there should feel free to incorporate this into their curriculum. The three great patriarchs of Judaism are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Christians and Muslims also trace their faith back to Abraham, so these three faiths are sometimes called the Abrahamic religions, who worship the God of Abraham. From Genesis chapter 17, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly." Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, exalted father, but your name shall be Abraham, father of many. For I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you, in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." And God said to Abraham, "As for you, you shall keep my covenant, and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generations. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant. He who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money must be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child, who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant." As part of the covenant with God, Abraham, age 99, and his wife Sarah, age 90, had a son named Isaac. This was Abraham's only son with Sarah, but with Sarah's blessing, he had previously fathered a son named Ishmael with an Egyptian slave. Upon Isaac's birth, Ishmael and his mother were sent away from the household. From Genesis chapter 21. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son." And the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice. For in Isaac your seed shall be called, yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed." It is through Ishmael that Muslims traced their tie to Abraham. Isaac was eventually married to Rebekah, and together they welcomed fraternal twin boys into the world, Esau and Jacob. The pregnancy was difficult, so to comfort Rebekah, God came to her and said, in Genesis chapter 25, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Esau was the elder brother and the favorite of Isaac, while Jacob was the favorite of Rebekah. As the elder brother, Esau was to inherit the covenant with God, but Esau was not a spiritual man. Again, from Genesis chapter 25, "Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, 'Please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary.' Therefore his name was called Edom, meaning red. But Jacob said, 'Sell me your birthright as of this day.' And Esau said, 'Look, I am about to die, so what is this birthright to me?' Then Jacob said, 'Swear to me as of this day.' So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob." Years later, when Isaac had gone blind in his old age, he decided it was time to bestow his blessing upon his chosen heir, Esau, and instructed his son to go on a hunt for an offering appropriate for such an occasion. While Esau was hunting, Rebekah dressed Jacob in furs and sent him in with their father to steal the blessing from Esau. When Esau realized he had been tricked out of his birthright, Jacob was forced to flee from his home. Thus, Jacob was established as the third patriarch of the Jewish people, and his descendants would go on to form the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob, very famously, displayed a great deal of favoritism amongst his sons, which caused issues for them later on. We are going to fast forward a little over the next, 1500 years or so. Archaeological evidence shows that the area of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah have been occupied since at least the early Iron Age, around 1100 BC, roughly corresponding to the flight of the Jews from Egypt and the wandering in the desert led by Moses, estimated to have occurred around 1300 BC. Around 950 BC, during the reign of King Solomon, construction of the first temple of Jerusalem was completed. Over the next 800 years, the kingdoms of Israel would go through periods of ascension and decline as they dealt with their powerful neighbors, including the Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, and Greeks. In 586 BC, the Babylonians conquered Israel and the first temple was destroyed, with many Jews forced into exile into other lands ruled by Babylon. This is around the period that the kingdom of Judah formed. Judah was one of Jacob's 12 sons, and his descendants were pretty good at staying neutral during various conflicts over time, which led defeated tribes to seek refuge in their land and help them maintain some measure of autonomy. The lands of Israel were conquered by Alexander the Great in the 320s BC. Upon Alexander's death, as his empire was divided amongst his generals, the lands of the Jewish people came under the dominion of Ptolemy Sotar in Egypt. Ptolemy's rule provided economic stability to the region, and his policy was to allow the Jews to practice their religion in peace as long as they paid their taxes and did not rebel. Over the next several decades, however, the Ptolemaic dynasty fought several wars with the Seleucid Empire for control over the region of Judea. Seleucus Nicator was another of Alexander's generals. Over the next century, the lands of Judea passed between their neighboring Hellenized empires. Greek culture had more and more influence amongst the people. Even the name Judea comes from the Greek translation of the Persian name for the area, Yehud. Greek became the primary language for communication in the region, and perhaps most scandalously, the Jews began to engage in athletic contests in the nude, violating traditional morality. In 168 BC, a group of Jews began a revolt against this Hellenization, which led the Seleucid emperor, Antiochus Epiphanes, to crack down hard. In an effort to eliminate Jewish culture, he had the temple in Jerusalem rededicated to Zeus. He banned circumcision and many other Jewish rituals, and many people caught openly practicing their religion were killed. In response, a strong resistance formed out of the town of Modin, located outside of Jerusalem. When a Seleucid military officer ordered a rabbi named Matthias to make a sacrifice to a pagan deity, Matthias refused and killed the officer. A group of rebels then fled the town into the nearby hills, which became the core of a liberation movement that was led by Matthias's five sons, known as the Maccabees. In 164 BC, after a Maccabee-led guerrilla army defeated the Seleucids, they re-entered Jerusalem and rededicated the Second Temple. This event is now commemorated each year with the holiday of Hanukkah. But that was not the end of the fighting, and over the next two decades, all of the Maccabee brothers died, with the last of them, Simon, consolidating power and winning recognition of Judea as an independent, autonomous region from the Seleucids before he died around 143 BC. Simon's son, John Hyrcanus, assumed the role of high priest and the national leader, and eventually his son, Aristobulus, would reign as King of the Jews, the first person to take that title since the Jewish defeat to the Babylonians 500 years earlier. This was the start of the Hasmonean dynasty that would rule for the next century. To help follow along, I've added a map of the relevant kingdoms during this period on Instagram, at GermaniaPod. During the rule of John Hyrcanus, the Kingdom of Judea expanded to its largest territorial extent since the time of King Solomon. This included the conquest of Edom. All of the residents of the newly conquered lands were forcibly converted to Judaism, including the grandfather of the man that we know as Herod the Great. Forced conversion obviously involved circumcision as a way of maintaining the covenant with God. Now, Herod the Great was born in the land of Edom in 73 BC. You may recall that in my readings from Genesis, Edom was another name used to refer to Jacob's brother Esau. Traditionally, this is understood as the land that Esau and his descendants settled in, and they had a contentious relationship with the Israelites over the previous 1,000 years. When Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, the king of Edom denied them the right to pass through his territory towards the Promised Land, forcing them to take a much longer route, which contributed to the 40 years wandering in the desert. At the time of Herod's birth, the Jewish people were ruled by the widow of their previous king. Queen Alexandra Salome had been married to the first king, Aristobulus, and when he died after only a brief reign, she married his brother, Alexander Jani. When Alexander died after a long reign, Alexandra succeeded him as the ruling monarch. She had a fairly successful decade on the throne from 76 to 67 BC, which included establishing protections for divorced and widowed women in Judea. According to Norman Gelb in his biography of Herod the Great, this is the origin for the concept of alimony. Judea maintained peaceful relationships with its neighbors, but during Alexander's reign, the seeds for internal division were sowed. Since the time of John Hyrcanus 60 years before, the Judean monarch had been both the leader of the political system as well as the high priest of Judaism. As a woman, Alexandra was barred from acting as high priest, so she appointed her son, John Hyrcanus II. As you can probably guess, based on the fact that Hyrcanus II wasn't able to take the throne upon his father's death, Alexandra's eldest son was not a man of competence or ambition. And that was not something that went unnoticed or that could be ignored. The revolt of the Maccabees was not even a century old at this point, and certainly the eldest citizens of Judea could remember a time when the existence of their nation was not a certainty. This was not the time to manage around a weak-willed ruler, so Alexandra became queen. Canis II was content in his role as high priest. This system might have worked, but unfortunately, Alexandra had a younger son, Aristobulus II, who was more dynamic, more ambitious, and who wanted both the crown and the priesthood for himself. And his strategy for obtaining them involved playing off the rivalry between the two major religious groups at this time, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees believed that the rules governing Jewish religious life were contained entirely within the Torah. Those rules were not open to interpretation and should not be expanded or influenced by other oral traditions from the past. The most prominent Sadducees formed the elite of Judean religious, economic, and social life. Perhaps counterintuitively, the Sadducees adjusted more easily to Hellenization, including adopting the Greek language. I suppose this could be read as their devotion to the primacy of the Torah, making other cultural changes more acceptable, or, more cynically, as the elite doing whatever was required to maintain their power. The Pharisees, on the other hand, believed that religious belief was more personal. While they also considered the Torah central to Judaism, they did not believe it was the only source of faith that was worth respect. Other interpretations and reflections on scripture by sages and scholars over the centuries had a place in the faith, particularly in areas where the Torah was too vague or which allowed for multiple interpretations. The Pharisees believed in an afterlife, that angels could communicate with humans as God's messengers, and that a Messiah would eventually appear among the Jews to prepare the world for God's kingdom. Since the Pharisees saw themselves as the only ones who could defend the true faith, and given that much of it was tied to oral traditions, they rejected Hellenization and refused to adopt the Greek language. The Pharisees maintained a stronger following among the general population. At this time, there was also a third, much smaller group, the Essenes, who lived in non-Hellenized, all-male, monastic communities, devoting themselves entirely to prayer and religious study to prepare for the arrival of the Messiah, which they believed to be imminent. We will spend very little time with them, though if you are a Christian, their belief in the imminent arrival of the Messiah, circa 70 BC, is interesting. Queen Alexandra favored the Pharisees, and as much rabbinic history comes from Pharisee writers, she is generally regarded positively. Her brother had been forced into exile by the Sadducee elite during her husband's reign, so during her reign, she and her brother spent time replacing Sadducees in positions of authority with Pharisee allies, and generally driving the Sadducees out of Jerusalem. This division opened up an opportunity for Aristobulus. With the Pharisees' ascendant, due to the power of his mother and brother, Aristobulus began to champion the cause of the Sadducees, winning over allies who had been close to his father. He got permission from his mother to establish sanctuaries for the Sadducees in the surrounding towns to limit the conflict between the two groups. When Alexandra died in 67 BC, Aristobulus used these allies to form the core of an army he used to usurp the throne from his elder brother. Hyrcanus made a brief attempt at resistance, but after an early defeat, he decided being brother of the king was a position that suited him just fine. So that is all straightforward enough. A monarch dies, there is a quick battle for succession between the two most obvious candidates, and the defeated yields to the victor. Aristobulus didn't even go to the trouble of executing his brother. The complicating factor was the governor of the current Judean province of Edom. Upon the Judean victory over Edom and the conversion of the people to Judaism, Hyrcanus I had selected a tribal leader, Antipas, as governor, to administer the territory and maintain the peace. When Antipas died, all his titles and property, including large herds of livestock and the rights to trade routes from Edom into Arabia, were inherited by his son Antipater. Antipater married a woman from a noble family in neighboring Nabatea, and together they started a family, which would eventually include a daughter and four sons, including the future Herod the Great. By the time of Herod's birth, Antipater had a large network of friends across the ruling elites of the region, facilitated by his charm and generosity with gifts, and he was sufficiently regarded that he was trusted to negotiate disputes between different parties from different kingdoms. One of the friends he had studiously cultivated was Hyrcanus II, the presumptive heir to the crown of Judea. It was not lost on Antipater that Hyrcanus was weak-willed and unambitious, and that meant that he was going to need close, trusted advisors to steer the kingdom for him, a kingdom that was now a powerful force militarily and economically in the region. Antipater planned to be the primary captain of the ship. So when Hyrcanus gave up almost immediately, Antipater was horrified. He was now just the friend of a downgraded ex-king, which left him exposed. Aristobulus II was sharp and ambitious. He would certainly want to install his own man as governor of Edom before long. To protect himself, Antipater sent several messages to Hyrcanus to convince him that remaining in Jerusalem as his brother's subordinate was madness. Hyrcanus was the legitimate successor, and over time he would almost certainly become the center of various conspiracy plots against Aristobulus, both real and imagined. It would be bad for business if his brother left him alive for too long. To save his life, Hyrcanus had to fight for his crown. Or, more accurately, he had to let Antipater do his fighting for him. Antipater arranged for Hyrcanus to flee to the safety of his wife's homeland. He made an agreement with the Nabatean king Aretas. In exchange for the return of 12 border towns the Judeans had captured from him, Aretas would provide an army of 50,000 Arabs to join with the army in Edom and the remaining forces loyal to Queen Alexandra. Hyrcanus, now had an army far more powerful than anything his brother could field, and Aristobulus was quickly driven back behind the walls of Jerusalem, which was then put under siege. So, that is all straightforward enough. One claimant to a throne negotiates support from foreign allies, forms an army more powerful than anything his opposition can muster, and takes control of the kingdom. But, as Aristobulus found himself besieged in Jerusalem, someone new wandered onto the scene. That person was Pompeius Magnus, Pompey the Great, and the Roman legions he led, who were in the process of bringing all of Asia Minor under the control of the Eternal City. Both Aristobulus and Antipater immediately saw it would be foolish to try and resist the Roman legions. Instead, they each sent envoys to Pompey to pledge their fealty to Rome and to petition to be allowed to rule Judea on their behalf. But Pompey rebuffed them both. He saw that Aristobulus was too strong-willed to be trusted in such a position, and Hyrcanus he would only allow to maintain the position of high priest. Judea would be allowed to maintain some autonomy, but it was stripped of much of the territory it had recently won. Gaza, Joppa, and other cities were made free and independent. Parts of Edom and Samaria were taken away. They lost access to the Mediterranean Sea, and the entire kingdom was placed under the control of the Roman governor of Syria, based in Damascus. Aristobulus and his followers attempted to resist, but that got them nowhere. Aristobulus was put in chains and shipped off to Rome to serve as a trophy in Pompey's eventual triumph, and the city of Jerusalem fell to the Roman legions in 63 BC, beginning half a millennia of Roman domination. In the ultimate sign of their defeat, the inhabitants of Jerusalem had to endure Pompey desecrating the Great Temple by entering the most sacred chamber, the Holy of Holies, as part of his search for treasure to take back to Rome. While Pompey left the temple intact and the building standing, he and his army stripped the rest of the city of its wealth and executed the leaders who had supported resistance to Rome. Judea was now a Roman province, and that status had a huge impact on the future of those who worship the God of Abraham.